I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Boost Your Biology podcast. My name is Lucas, and I'm the founder of Ergogenic Health. Together in this podcast series, we will go underground to explore cutting-edge health and human performance insights that you simply cannot search on Google to help you upgrade your existence. So without any further ado, let's jump into today's episode.
What's up, everyone, and welcome back to the Boost Your Biology podcast. Today's discussion will be focusing in on oxandrolone, otherwise known as Anavar. And joining me on the show is Nick Fearon. Nick, welcome to the show.
G'day, mate. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well, This is, for those wondering, this is actually our second podcast together. You featured on another one previously, which was the Leo longevity discussion. And actually there was another one before that as well, which was the lipoflux. But Nick, maybe do you want to just share with my listeners a little bit about your backstory, who you are and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Nick. Known in sort of the cyberspace as Fury and M-Farm. I guess professionally, I'm a former pharmacist and a current medicinal chemist. My education started basically when I left high school, did a Bachelor of Human Nutrition, then I did a Bachelor of Health Science Complementary Medicine, then a Master's of Pharmacy, then Graduate Diploma of Medicinal Chemistry. Sort of worked in various fields all through there. Essentially got interested in sort of fitness and that sort of thing, and then sort of focused my extracurricular sort of studies, if you will, around all sorts of things that are related to the health and fitness. And that's probably taken us to where we are today.
Awesome. It doesn't sound like you've been studying for that long there, Nick. So
I think it was what are we looking at? Maybe 11 years in total, including internships. So
And you're always learning as well. I mean, I know you're always at the cutting edge. You know, you're sending me studies all the time, and we're always like bouncing ideas and sending research articles. Definitely respect the work that you do. And I definitely look up to you in the space of understanding, the intricate details around different supplements, herbal extracts, anabolic agents. So obviously in today's discussion, we're going to be focusing in on oxandrolone, Anavar, for those listening in. We're really going to go deep on this particular, this drug. So maybe, Nick, did you want to first of all outline What is Anavar?
So Anavar is actually the proprietary name for the oral androgen medicine oxandrolone, as you mentioned. Other proprietary names include Lonavar, which is the product that CSL Pharma Group that was approved in Australia in 1994 and was made under license under Biotech General, who are the makers of oxandrin in other countries, which is the originator product. I believe the originator company who hold the 1960s patent for oxandrolone synthesis and application and also other 17 oxygenated oxysteroids was Searle & Co, which are now, I believe, absorbed by Pfizer. But they went through a few different changes. There were Savient Pharmaceuticals in between there as well. And they sold that product, Anavar, which is obviously now in a colloquial name, is because that product probably doesn't even exist anymore. So interesting, this patent from Searle describes a series of androstains and estranes where the A ring of the steroid nucleus contains a lactone structure. So if you're looking at the steroid nucleus, it's that first little ring down on the lower left, like that's generally how it's presented, depending on its sort of topography. And this one, more simply, contains the carbon 2 or the oxygen you see in that first ring. That's the unique structural feature of oxandrolone compared to other steroids, both within any approval or therapeutic or otherwise. Like it really is unique. So that unique to oxa steroid development did lead to some limited further research in the 1960s, which saw some interesting research into two oxoestradienes. They're kind of like nortestosterones. More specifically, 2-oxodienolone and 2-oxomethyldienolone, which in the experiments outperformed the methyl testosterone controls. But these never really seemed to go anywhere in development. So I assume because of the complexity of the costs that would have been involved in the synthesis. And similarly, there've been sort of 2-oxomodified steroid molecules synthesized and developed as androgens, anti-androgens, estrogens, progestins, anti-progestins. As far as I'm aware, any of those have actually become approved medicines. There's only one called ociterone, which is a progestin anti-androgen. I believe it's really only got veterinary use too with this modification. So as it stands in the 60-odd years of its use, oxandrolone is really unique in this respect. That's sort of what sets it aside.
So when it comes to like drug development, things like that, and with Anavar itself, is it actually a derivative of testosterone? Do you want to sort of explain how they
manufacture? Yeah, so it's probably more closely a DHT, because realistically, other than that sort of modification that I mentioned, it doesn't have a carbon 4-5 double bond, which is what a reducible androgen like testosterone does have. So so if you look at the basic skeleton, that's what it would be, DHT with a carbon 17 alpha position methyl substitute, which is used to confer its oral bioavailability. So that's like common amongst oral steroids. It's very actually quite a very efficient way to increase oral bioavailability of oral androgens. So it's probably more like DHT in that sense, but realistically, when you look at a broader as an androgen, like we sort of scale everything against testosterone. So so the testosterone effects that you would get from oxandrolone in therapeutic application is what we're scaling against.
Yeah. So let's have a look at it from like the therapeutic context. Let's have a look at the original use for the medication. Let's have a look at maybe what was the original function and use in medicine for this particular drug?
So for the actual intended therapeutic applications, these are actually numerable, like over the years. So as both approved and also off-label indications. So these indications are dated now. So when we take the complete sphere of the pharmacology, safety and effectiveness in these conditions and weigh them up against other medications used for these indications, a rationalization for oxandrolone prescription becomes pretty thin in 2023. So to preface this, like I thought maybe we could probably should consider that many androgen derivatives that have found their way into sort of, as PED agents have in most instances being developed for legitimate therapeutic purposes, like in the yesteryear. And much like oxandrolone, this has primarily taken place where there was a where there was less stringent requirements for drug approval. I mean, like even way less red tape for ethical approvals to do a clinical trial to test them than we even have sort of dating back to like even the early 80s. So have you heard of the pioneering US pharmacologist Frances Kelsey?
No.
Okay. So she was essentially, I guess you'd say, the mother of modern day drug testing procedures and regulation and how these are tied into medicine approval. So she was a pharmacologist that essentially set the foundation principles for drug safety testing from a regulatory perspective in the US. And as a result, then worldwide, it sort of bled out worldwide slowly after that of the preceding decades. And so she was a reviewer for the FDA in the States. And she refused in the 60s, she refused the authorization of thalidomide because she didn't think it held sort of convincing evidence of data and safety. This is after being approved in the US, I think it was in the UK, most European countries. So you know what thalidomide is, right?
Is it diuretic or something?
No, thalidomide, it's a sedative and a painkiller, but it was used in the 60s and in some countries much later than that, for morning sickness in women, and it was it caused birth defects, serious birth defects, and like this was an approved medicine. So this was like the hallmark sort of landmark in drug testing, where this woman said, "No, you know, I don't want to approve this medicine." And as a result, like she saved like U.S. mothers, you know, being born with babies with short limbs, because that's what's the birth defect it caused in the 60s. And so that was kind of like, you know, the world sort of had to step up their drug testing game and set some rather more stringent parameters, you know, for drug testing. And obviously this was sort of in and around and a little bit before the period where a lot of these androgens were starting to go through clinical trials for their application. So we sort of have to keep that in the back of our mind when we're assessing safety data and indications, because I was sort of pre-Kelsey influence. But yeah. But even then, like, you know, you look at some of those trials, like we're talking for like things like methanolone, which the proprietary name is primobolan. And then there's drostanolone, proprietary name is Masterin or Masteril. It's got a few different names. And you look at some of the data from that there, dating back at that time. And then you look at the very specific parameters tested. Like, back then, we didn't really even have like lipoprotein cholesterol assays, you know what I mean? And so we now know that's significantly skewed. And like even for oxandrolone, like there was a suggestion in some of the trial data that it might actually be beneficial in treating hyperlipidemia. You know, that's back then. So obviously if we're going to use those sort of safety and therapeutic the data that was used to derive these therapeutic indications, and we probably should approach it pretty cautiously. But in saying that, oxandrolone, it doesn't really exactly apply to oxandrolone specifically in full, so I've gone off a bit of a tangent. We'll bring it back here. Due to the orphan drug designation by the FDA in the aforementioned relicensing, someone I was saying was going through those relicensing, there's been more dribs and drabs approach to assessing and publishing safety trials, and the reason for this is expanding those indications, and obviously the regulatory requirements would come to that. So as a result, we have a bit more modern day safety data, which we can get into a bit later. So it was original. So to answer your question all the way back here, so we've got that preface out of the way. It was originally approved by the FDA for regaining weight loss from infectious disease, whereas primarily used in AIDS patients.
Let's look at that there. So like if one of their uses is to help re-facilitate weight gain following severe infection or illness, I mean, there would have been so many other options to use, right? They could have used like a appetite stimulant. They could have used cyproheptadine.
I guess like the actual pathology of these conditions wasn't exactly nutted out then. I mean, we had like for AIDS, for instance, we had no antivirals back then. Like it was kind of like a preservation thing rather than an actual treatment thing. Applying our sort of modern wisdom to it, there's probably many different ways that we could have gone about these things differently. But then again, we probably wouldn't have, we'd never have these drugs if that was the case.
Good point, yeah.
Um, yeah. Yeah. So, and then so BTG, that biotechnology group that that sort of took over the licensing, they expanded it to include weight loss after severe trauma, such as burns, major surgery and infections, malnutrition due to alcoholic cirrhosis, as well as growth retardation in genetic syndromes and also muscular dystrophy diseases. So it got, like, back then, you know, you didn't exactly have a huge smorgasbord of drugs you could select from. So these sorts of things sort of got approved with, with no sort of competition against other agents. And then it also gained approval for bone pain due to osteoporosis.
Do they have the, like, the dosage ranges they were using back then?
Yeah. So I'll get into the dosing when we go through the pharmacokinetics, but everything seems to be standardized at 0.1 milligram per kilo. Some of it went up higher, like, but that was sort of in sort of, consultant off-label use where they were treating some very rare anemic diseases. And I don't know whether there was any sort of therapeutic guidelines for that. It was probably just more consultant experience doing that. And that's probably where, like, actually that data, interestingly, is where we get some of the, probably the more sort of rarer side effect data where you're sort of pushing those doses higher. Cause I mean, like, we can use, like, case reports from anabolic steroid abuse, but they're only sort of, only useful so far because, like, you know, there's many, many different limitations to those. But yeah. Mm. So in Australia, we used oxandrolone in 1994. It got approved. And that was Lonovar. That was approved for pediatric growth disorders like pathological short stature on the back of safety trials performed in the 1980s and the 1990s. Wow. Yeah. So I guess in these trials in quite young children that really make oxandrolone's established safety profile distinct from other androgens
And also, this was only oral administration.
It was designed, like, it was long ago worked out that 17 alpha position, that carbon 17 alpha methyl substitution to androgens confers oral bioavailability. So on the back of that, and obviously, and something that they worked out later with that unique modification that I mentioned, that two OXA modification, it was always going to be given as an oral medication. And, like, when you're looking at treating children with growth disorders, I can't imagine that, you know, injections, you know, back then would be a very sort of convenient way to administer it. So that's obviously how that safety profile was established. And then there's existing trial data collecting 119 burn participants post year 2000. So I think that's when they first started collecting the data. The study was published in, like, 2006. So this is obviously in an area where clinical trial registration would have to meet an acceptable standard for modern times, where the children's mean age was 8.5, who met the criteria, which was 30%. Total body surface area burn, were either given a standard of care, which in some instances of the standard of care included growth hormone, or 0.1 milligram per kilo of oxandrolone twice daily for 2 whole years. So it was used for 2 years at twice daily. So if it's a child weighing 50 kilos, you know, it's about 10 milligrams every single day, twice a day for 2 years. So that's, you know, with that sort of data, that's what I'm saying, like, you know, oxandrolone sort of different from, you know, the older androgens tested in the 70s, because we have that sort of trial data now, comparatively. Yeah. Mm. So I don't know, if we want to go into safety, I thought probably be best if we go over, like, the pharmacokinetics and dynamics any bits you want to nut out from that, mate.
Well, I think what's important to note here is so you mentioned, like, that trial duration in that pediatric population group, the fact that this is an orally active compound, maybe it's worthwhile now sort of exploring what happens in the body following ingestion, maybe look at the pharmacokinetics, and pharmacodynamics.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so as we've mentioned, oxandrolone has very good oral bioavailability. So with the pharmacokinetics, we'll start there. We go absorption, distribution, elimination. I'll go over each parameter and how they sort of tie into each other. So I did a rough calculation of the established pharmacokinetic parameters, because there was no real information on the actual bioavailability as it being tested. Like, it was in the like you can look up the product information leaflets from all those prior products, and they say they don't really mention it in there at all. But anyway, I used the area under the curve, and I worked out it's around about 97%, which is in line with like the Wikipedia and like the dodgy website citation. So I guess there's some degree of that, and it's also because it's the we do have elimination data and excretion data. You can see that around about 3 to 5% is excreted in feces as well. So it's probably assumed that there's limitations in the absorption, and that's made its way through. So that sort of does weigh up too. So
how does that compare with other orally active steroids?
They've all got pretty good oral bioavailability. As I said, that substitution at the carbon 17 with a methyl or an ethyl group or any sort of alkyl group, that really does seem to offset that first pass effects and allow it to get into concentrations. What I'll get into with the difference with oxandrolone is that metabolic stability is not only as a result of that 17 carbon substitution, it's also a result of that unique feature that we mentioned earlier, that A ring to oxa substitution. So I'll get into that, but basically that in itself allows it to have a longer half-life and right. probably more capacity to exert the anabolic effects without risk of metabolic biotransformation. So, but we'll get into
right.
Yeah. Anyway, it also absorbs really quickly. So, the T max or the time to maximum concentration is actually only 1 hour. Interesting. I've seen people in the social media spaces suggesting sublingual administration might be more beneficial to expedite the first pass effect, or assumedly peak the concentration sooner before going to the gym.
As like a pre-workout, I've heard that.
I've seen that cited. So I'll get to the first pass effect in a second, but for the optimization of peak concentration in a timely manner, I'm not too sure we can improve on an hour. there's a study performed using an oil-based sublingual preparation of oxandrolone in comparison to a swallowed tablet that found for the sublingual formula, there's a lower Cmax, so a lower maximum concentration reached, slower Tmax, so it takes longer to get to that Cmax, and then less area under the curve, which means that the total body exposure to the drug is actually less. So given these measures and the high oral bioavailability, first pass effect is probably non-existent for affecting oxandrolone pharmacokinetic profile. And for what it's worth, the purpose of that study, that comparing the oil-based sublingual preparation to the tablet was to determine the usability in of sublingual preparation in neonates, so in young babies, but it also had an arm for adults. So that's probably absorption covered there. So we can move on to distribution. It would appear that it has a low to medium volume of distribution, so that's a calculated volume of distribution at around 500 mils per kilo, which is probably in line with the two compartment model pharmacokinetic profile it has, where it has a high plasma protein binding. So I think it's around over 95% is bound to plasma proteins. So from a broad perspective, high plasma binding might also explain the extended half-life. So we'll go into half-life in a minute, but in terms of like that extended half-life, it's actually a very beneficial parameter for an oral androgen, especially for the therapeutic indications that it's used for. So the volume of distribution calculated at therapeutically relevant concentration, so that's that 0.1 milligram per kilo twice a day, would suggest that not a great deal of oxandrolone will make it into lipophilic tissue, such as the fat tissue or the brain. We can't really make much more inferences from that calculation alone, but it might explain the little noted effect on the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis in children using therapeutically relevant doses for the hypomethylating.
That was going to be my next point is like with a lot of these orally active steroids, I'd assume that most of them would have the ability to cross the blood-brain barrier.
Yeah, I mean, like a steroid itself is, you know, it's a steroid nucleus. So, you know, it's a cholesterol molecule. So realistically, it probably could and probably will. But with that high plasma protein binding, sort of retaining and maybe, for want of a better term, disseminating oxandrolone around the body, the capacity to transverse the blood-brain barrier or other membranes is probably limited by the fact that it can it will be, you know, disattached from the plasma proteins in a more uniform manner. So where you're getting sort of like, you know, if we're looking at specifically at that HPG suppression, the parameters that you'd probably be most concerned with would be the capacity to accumulate, lower plasma binding where it passed through. So,
with a young population, the pediatrics, did they not ever think about the fact that it might have any suppression?
Well, the thing was they did test that in the later indications, and if there was any suppression, it was like not necessarily clinically relevant. So so it was only, remember, we're talking very low doses here. So
we should explain to the audience here what suppression means. So maybe do you want to explain, term suppression is used in the PED space. Do you want to explain that?
Yeah. So basically it is androgenic suppression is suppression of your gonadotrophins. So your gonadotrophins being luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone. This occurs with androgen use and evidently probably scaled at dosing depending on the androgen itself. I mean, like testosterone will reliably shut down even at very low doses, but oxandrolone is not as strong effect. But basically what will happen is the androgen will bind into receptors at the hypothalamus, which will then reduce the signaling to the pituitary and to release luteinizing hormone, which then doesn't happen. Luteinizing hormone, with the absence of low concentration of luteinizing hormone, follicle stimulating hormone, you get less production of your sex steroids at your gonadal tissues, either testicles or ovaries. Yeah. So that's it probably in a nutshell. There's a little bit more complexity to that. I'll probably stay away from that because there's all sorts of things that go on with testosterone and estrogen, and then estrogen in isolation, then androgens in isolation. A lot of this has been sort of nutted out from SARM research,
I might actually, I might also add one point there as well with suppression for those listening in. This is usually occurs with exogenous, so external use of an anabolic or androgenic agent that's going to, you know, trick the body into thinking that it's, you know, it affects the HPG axis, as Nick alluded to. So that's really important to consider. And so when we're looking at Anavar, I mean, so what have they noted that in these, like in the pediatric population, this 0.1 milligram per kilogram of body weight, like, did they actually measure whether or not it had any suppression?
Yeah. So some of the research, they weren't specifically testing like luteinizing hormone or follicle stimulating hormone,
right?
Nothing that I come across seemed to have that in there. But if they looked at like testosterone, estrogen concentrations, and saw and noted little to no differences, no clinically relevant differences in there.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, it's I guess like. Yeah, going on the sort of kinetic parameters that we've already gone over and sort of staying on topic as well. You look at something like an androgen that's like, let's just say like an androgen replacement of like testosterone and FA, you know, if you were to inject that, you're going to get a really sort of steady supply of it. You know what I mean? Like it's not going to mimic your... it's not going to mimic your diurnal rhythms. You know what I mean? So you're going to have, always have a certain level there where there's not going to be, well, there will be peaks and troughs depending on your administration intervals, but there's always going to be sort of that basal level that, that might not necessarily reflect what happens on an average during your day. So when you go and get a testosterone blood test, as someone who doesn't use exogenous androgens, you get it first thing in the morning to try and get that LH surge, you're going to get like a peak level, but during the day, it's going to go up and down. You know what I mean? So, and that's all homeostatically controlled so that your testosterone doesn't get suppressed by your own testosterone production. You know what I mean? So like, you know, you produce too much testosterone, but it does actually do that, but it does it on sort of micro levels. Right. So when you're looking at androgen replacement, things like this, like testosterone and anthode, you're going to have that basal level. And with oxandrolone, obviously there's clearly some sort of dose influence here. But with oxandrolone, there is those breaks. Like if they were to dose it, I mean, it's a 9-hour half-life. So you will reach a steady state concentration, but where that actually falls in terms of like an equivalence, which we don't have any data on, to what you would normally produce as a, you know, in testosterone, it's probably lower at a lower threshold. Well, clearly it is at a lower threshold because it's not suppressing as much as something else would, another androgen would.
So what about
at the therapeutically relevant doses?
So what about from like a, like the safety aspect? I mean, obviously in that study, they've assessed whether or not it has like a strong suppressive effect on endogenous testosterone production. But what about, did they assess like liver function and kidney function?
So the liver functions, I was going to go to safety afterwards. If you want to finish the pharmacokinetics, because a lot of the safety data, if we got the pharmacokinetic sort of context, we can sort of relate that back, if that makes sense. Yeah. Yep. Happy to go there now, but I reckon it'd probably be better if we go through the rest of the kinetics and then the dynamics, and then we can look at safety in respect to that. So the metabolism more broadly, because oxandrolone has that basic pharmacophore, like that basic skeletal structure of dihydrotestosterone, hallmarked by that absence of the 4-5 bond. It's not a substrate for aromatase, and it's not a substrate for 5-alpha reductases. Pretty much all androgens, save for some, offset by steric hindrance at certain substitutions. That carbon 4-5, the absence of that carbon 4-5 double bond, basically makes it not a substrate for aromatase or not a substrate for 5-alpha reductase. So this alone gives it a bit more metabolic stability, meaning that it's those major pathways of biotransformation of androgens don't occur, and the drug's active life itself is likely only limited by minor metabolic profiles and its elimination rate. But we can get to the elimination rate in a second. Do you got any questions about that, Mike?
Well, that's a really important point. With that, those different pathways. So for example, if somebody were to take testosterone exogenously, then it's prone to going down either that 5-alpha reductase pathway or the aromatase pathway. But you're saying this does not apply with Anavar?
No, it doesn't apply with Anavar. And it's that absence of that carbon 4-5 bond that seems to be the main driver of that, but that also the alpha ring, the A ring substitution, which I'll get into in a minute, seems to also have some sort of effect on that as well, reducing the major biotransformation pathways being aromatization or 5-alpha reduction. And then there's also the other minor pathways that are involved in it, that oxandrolone does seem to go down a very small amount, but not to the effect, not to the point of any sort of drug interactions or anything like that. So it's a pretty stable molecule. So I guess from the metabolism, we can go into I'll go into those details of its metabolism. That oxygen substitution at the carbon 2 of the A ring, so that steronucleus, that unique feature that we've spoke about, is likely a major determining factor in its metabolic stability when compared to other 17 alpha alkylated androgens. Not too much is known why this is the case, but it would appear much like the pyrazole ring attachment in the A ring of stenozolol. So stenozolol is a unique oral androgen as well. It's got a pyrazole ring attached to pyrazole ring attachment to the A ring of the steroid nucleus, much like that. Seems to provide some sort of steric hindrance to the reduction of the carbon 3 alpha keto group. So that's in the A ring there. You'll see the double bond to the oxygen. That's the carbon three alpha keto group. That sort of provides that both that two oxy substitution oxandrolone and the pyrazole ring in stenozolol seems to sterically hinder 3-alpha hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase that normally will reduce that. So that's a sort of a semi-minor metabolic profile, a metabolic enzyme that's somewhat inhibited by that. So that's conferred by that modification. So this is further evidenced by the fact that the kinetic data suggests that oxandrolone is predominantly eliminated renally unchanged, with only a very few minor conjugated metabolites that still maintain that 2-oxa-DHT skeleton. So even though they've gone through the body, you've urinated them out, most of it, I think it's somewhere in the order of 60% is, or 40 to 60% is the original molecule itself, and the other ones are a conjugated 2-oxa-DHT derived metabolites. So out of the many that exist, the most readily retrievable is categorized as carbon 16 beta position hydroxylated form of oxandrolone. So it's clearly gone through some sort of 16 beta steroid dehydrogenase biotransformation. That's only at a very, very minor degree. So with this in mind, I don't see how the concomitant use of like a CYP3A4 inhibitor, such as grapefruit juice, would have any appreciable effect on metabolic profile of oxandrolone. This is also something else I've seen recently in social media posts that's left my head scratching. So as far as I'm aware, CYP3A4 does not act at a steroid 16 beta hydroxylase reaction. So even if it did, it would probably be inconsequential in the scheme of predominantly unchanged renal elimination pathway of oxandrolone. A lot of unusual things that go
well,
on.
Maybe sort of explain that to my audience. So what Nick's referring to there is the fact that some people are, you know, using this anavar in conjunction with grapefruit juice, hoping that it would extend the effects. Is that their hope?
Either extend the effects or maybe increase its oral bioavailability. I actually don't know, but yeah, like this goes back to, I think we spoke about this on the maybe it was the second podcast we did, where people think that there's these sort of bioavailability skeleton keys, and grapefruit juice is one of them, piperine's the other one. If you use grapefruit juice with a substrate for CYP3A4, then yeah, you could probably do those things, extend its half-life by reducing its metabolic deactivation or inactivation or even biotransformation. But when you've got a profile like oxandrolone, where it's essentially going through the body unchanged, urinating it out, and the enzymes responsible for the minor changes that occur to some of the drug have got absolutely nothing to do with CYP3A4. Makes no sense.
I'm curious to know, I doubt there are any studies on whether or not they've combined testosterone with oxandrolone
there's only very few of them, and they tend to be only case reports. I think it's Fanconi's disease is the really rare anemia type disorder where they use like a few anabolic agents to treat the patients. It's obviously dated now, but there's only so much you can derive from that when like the primary outcomes of those studies are looking at treating the disease that's pretty dire disease. So there is those. I didn't really look into them very much because there's only so much you can glean. But in those studies, there was notable liver toxicity put in there. That's probably the most overt thing that they could measure when they're doing these sort of case reports. So they tend to sort of fall under a different categorization when they're when they're not necessarily getting it approved for an indication that's more common. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've done absorption, distribution, metabolism, excretion.
We're going to elimination now. So it's got a two compartment elimination model. So, so which is what we'd expect for a drug with a rapid Tmax. So it was within 1 hour and high protein binding. So this includes the rapid distribution phase where the drug is present really only in the central compartment or the blood, and then the slower elimination phase where the drug is assumed to have reached the perfused tissues such as the muscle. So this is probably ideal for an orally active anabolic agent. The elimination rate is sort of twofold, where the elimination phase half-life, the time we assume it reached 50% of its dose has reached the target tissue or the muscle, is around about 9 hours, as we mentioned earlier. So with this in mind, the steady state concentration is probably reached after 2 to 3 days of twice day dosing. That's its elimination. Yeah.
Yep. So now I guess we could probably look at safety profile, maybe.
I was thinking maybe we'll go to the dynamics now.
Dynamics.
I can go into a fair bit of detail on the dynamics because this is for oxandrolone. And what we understand of like the older style measurements of anabolic to androgenic ratios, which still sort of have some relevance depending on how they're used, we can sort of look at some of the modern ideas with that you know I found interesting that might make for some new information that other people might not have ever really looked at. I thought that might be interesting, seeing as that's kind of your shtick, mate. So quite obviously, oxandrolone is an androgen, and thus we'd expect it to the primary interactions to be with the androgen receptor. So on the whole, there's much nuance to this, though, where we're able to discern the specific pharmacodynamic profile in respect to such aspects as tissue selectivity and resultant transcriptome, when the androgen receptor is activated. And some of this nuance has been experimentally assessed specifically with oxandrolone, but I'll get to that in a minute. So with it being a DHT analog, as we've prior described, by virtue of the oxandrolone structure, we can follow the modern lines of what is understood of steroid hormone intracellular trafficking, or the nuts and bolts of what might constitute the difference or the relevance of the old Hershberger assays, results of the SE where they compared a whole heap of anabolic drugs. You know what the Hershberger assays are? I think we've gone over that in prior ones.
Yeah, mentioned it briefly last
year. Yeah. So basically they'll get male rats, castrate them, they'll give them scale dosing of anabolic agents and testosterone as the control, and then they'll over a period of time, and then they'll basically kill them, harvest the testes, seminal vesicles, ventral prostate, and the levator ani.
With some of the herbal extracts, they actually don't they do assessments on like levator ani, testicles, like weight.
Yeah, so it's like as a model, like those particular organs and muscles of the rat, you know, they're set to correspond to either anabolic or androgenic activity. So there is like I think I sent you that Tenospora cordifolia paper where they're looking at that. So like it's I guess like it has been like in the modern day of like metabolomics and transcriptomics, where we're able to sort of look at what actually happens after an androgen's bound to an androgen receptor, they're probably somewhat obsolete now. They'll only get more obsolete when the technology advances, but they've still sort of served as a pretty good yardstick. And even sort of into modern time, the validation of them tends to hold up to some degree, depending. So according to the experiments on oxandrolone, it seems to be an average anabolic to androgenic ratio of 10 to 1 as compared to testosterone. So that's derived from the scaling doses of oxandrolone and testosterone in the rat model from 400 micrograms per day per rat through to 2,000 micrograms per day per rat. So what's important to note in those calculations, these were an average. And if you do look at the actual results themselves, so the weight differences, you can see the androgenic measures, i.e. the measure of the androgenic tissues, the weight, increased disproportionately to the anabolic measures as the doses increased. So which would suggest a reduction in that tissue selectivity, or as we'll go into, perhaps instigated more intracellular trafficking that is associated with the androgenic effect, much the same as testosterone. So for the reference, the top end of this scale in the rat model was 2 milligrams per rat per day. And this is equivalent to 2.2 milligrams per kilo as a human equivalent dose, which in itself is 22 times greater than the therapeutically prescribed dose. But even a human equivalent dose of 1 milligram per kilo skewed that androgenic impact by about 100%. So the actual threshold for titrating the dose and minimizing the androgenic activity is actually pretty narrow. If we're going to use that as the standard, and as I said, they tend to sort of stand the test of time. So we have to remember, though, that the extrapolation of this rat model to human model as a yardstick of the androgenic effect is somewhat fraught with inaccuracy for many factors, some including which we'll get into with further pharmacodynamic data I'll go through. So at the physiologically and therapeutically relevant concentration, the DHT pharmacophore seems to interact with the androgen receptor and initiate translocation to nucleus in a way that is different to androgens with the carbon 4-5 double bond like testosterone. So what I'm saying there is DHT acts differently to testosterone. We know that DHT is a more potent androgen, but the reasons why for that are only in terms of like what happens as an intracellular cascade after it's bound is only really, we're only just sort of working that out now. And it's actually seems to be related to some of the other effects that we're able to sort of discern between dihydrotestosterone and testosterone.
When you say, and this is obviously, we see this time and time again, is DHT being more potent than testosterone. Do you mean in its ability to bind to the receptors or activate?
Yeah. It will bind preferentially, depending on the concentration. But the actual from binding to transcription, it is more potent in terms of like out competing. Yeah. So this might be the reason why DHT analogs seem to confer some tissue selectivity compared to testosterone and other androgens with the carbon 4-5 double bond in the steroid skeleton. So the binding dynamics and metabolomics that seem to underpin some of this have taken a more granular advance in recent time with the advent of non-steroidal SARMs, such as the androgen receptor agonists and also SARM antagonists. And not to the point of being able to design very, very precise medicines, like we're not quite there yet, but where we can make some plausible correlations to the therapeutically relevant anabolic to androgenic ratios that do seem to check out from these in vitro experiments when correlated to the therapeutic application. I mean, as we can see, it seems to check out with that 0.1 milligram per kilo dose and low suppression. So if we're going to use the suppression as a yardstick and correlate that back into those Hirschberger assays, it seems to check out there. So these mechanistic theories of tissue selectivity have existed for a while with SERM. So we understand them to a more advanced degree with SERMs like tamoxifen or clomiphene, so they're selective estrogen receptor site modulators. But there's only sort of 20 years of data for SARMs and SARM anti-androgens and androgens in general. And they're based upon the theory of squelching, something called squelching, which is it's kind of like the preferential recruitment of nuclear receptor co-activators and co-repressors. So it's the profile of co-activators and co-repressors is something that occurs after the steroid hormone is bound to its nuclear receptor. So it'll change conformation, recruit co-activators, co-repressors, then translocate. So it's suggested that the androgen receptor conformation change upon binding between DHT, the dihydrotestosterone, testosterone, may see sequestering of co-activators or co-repressors inside the cell that may then have a cascade effect that reduces or inhibits other steroid receptors from translocating to the nucleus. So do you want me to explain that again? So basically, it appears that the way that DHT binds into the androgen receptor causes a conformational change to that androgen receptor that allows it to preferentially recruit these necessary co-activators or co-repressors of the androgen receptor that allows it to then translocate into the nucleus and then become active. So it kind of like pinches them from testosterone. So by doing that, testosterone and estrogen to some degree, because they do have common co-activators and co-repressors, can be sort of surrendered as a result of dihydrotestosterone binding or dihydrotestosterone analog oxandrolone binding. So it appears that the very broad DHT intracellular trafficking, which is that, you know, that recruitment of co-activators or co-repressors that might confer its potency over testosterone or potentially reduce or inhibit or modulate the activation of the receptor and then the translocation of even estrogen or glucocorticoid receptors into the nucleus. So it's a somewhat proven theory. So we can take it a potentially validating example of like gyno, for instance, with the use of a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor. You're reading me, mate. you're two steps ahead. this is why we complement each other. You take a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor, inhibit the 5-alpha reductase enzyme, which generally is expressed local tissue. So testosterone goes into the cell, acts in like a paracrine type manner, autocrine type manner in the particular cell. With it not converting to DHT, the estrogen profile or the testosterone to estrogen profile might dominate, and therefore you get your estrogen related sides, which could be gynecomastia. So that's probably the nuts and bolts of that. So where I'm going with all this is the DHT analog, such as oxandrolone, which is metabolically stable, able to achieve therapeutically active serum levels, and unlike DHT, it's primarily produced, which is primarily produced at the DHT at the tissue level. So oxandrolone, you've got it in your serum at these therapeutically relevant concentrations. DHT doesn't circulate in very, very large degrees. More or less produced at the most of it is produced at the tissue level. So with oxandrolone, it's essentially unregulated, whereas DHT naturally produced is regulated.
Isn't DHT like not orally bioavailable? Is that
you have to add that 17 methyl substitution, and they do use 17 methyl testosterone as a control for a lot of things, as a sort of a proxy for DHT, intramuscular administration is not really possible. And I'm not even sure whether you can add an ester to DHT itself.
DHT, it's using cream form, like topical application?
But it'd be the free base. There's no capacity to control its metabolism or its profile, its pharmacokinetic profile. So because of oxandrolone and those particular parameters of oxandrolone, it may have preferential capacity to induce androgen receptor mediated anabolic transcriptome, whilst minimizing or even offsetting those androgenic or estrogenic profiles. So because of those, that intracellular trafficking. Obviously, when I was sort of reading this, sort of like, you know, sort of tying it back into oxandrolone, I went down another rabbit hole and sort of looking at the the indirect anti-glucocorticoid effects of oxandrolone. So I was running off this same premise where oxandrolone appears to negatively regulate the glucocorticoid modulated gene expression via an indirect action mediated through the androgen receptor. So it suggests that upon binding to the AR, it can actually form a heterodimer or a complexation. So the androgen receptor and the glucocorticoid receptor, which would suppress the glucocorticoid receptor transactivating into the nucleus. Wow. So it's kind of like an indirect anti-cortisol effect, so to speak. So much like the squelching, which was that the co-repressor, co-activator.
Did you want to sort of explain that anti-cortisol or the glucocorticoid receptor? It's not, you're saying it's not an antagonist for the
not a direct antagonist. It won't slot into the glucocorticoid receptor preferentially to exogenous or endogenous glucocorticoids. But what it will do is, what it seems to do, which is sort of validated by the research in like burns victims and such, what it would seem to do is reduce the capacity of the cortisol to bind to the receptor and then induce the change. Yeah. So you know, in a hypermetabolic state, such as like what you get with burns and things like that, that might be one of the reasons why it's so therapeutically active in comparison to even other androgens.
So basically, it's to a degree offsetting the catabolic nature of hypercortisol, because the cortisol has a catabolic action. You're saying it actually shrinks or reduces muscle tissue?
Yeah. I mean, like in a hypercatabolic state, you're going to be churning through muscle tissue where there's excess cortisol mediated glucocorticoid receptor activation. So obviously that's, you know, as a result, the result of the burns. And then also, I think even one of the early indications was in long-term high dose corticosteroid use. So for treating certain conditions. So where basically that increased protein turnover, you're basically putting somewhat of a governor on that as well as, you know, the androgen receptor mediated anabolic activity. So it's kind of like even though that glucocorticoid receptor sequestering pathway might only be minor, it's kind of like a 1-2 punch. Yeah.
Would the action or the indirect effect on that GR receptor have any effect on body fat or like adipose tissue?
I think it's probably only relevant in sort of where it's where there's overactivation of the glucocorticoid receptor. So, but potentially maybe in like some sort of inflammatory obesity condition. I don't know, and I don't think it's anywhere. But yeah, I mean, like there's other conditions, you know. But yeah, it seems to be. Well, all the data's done in trauma, so there's only so far we can really extrapolate that.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Awesome. So then, did you have a next point you're going to bring up after that? So we've done the absorption, distribution, metabolism, elimination. Yep. We've done safety profile.
Yeah, and then the pharmacodynamics that we've sort of gone over now. I mean, like, there's another rabbit hole we could go down, but it's a little bit more speculative. Where there's the DHT. It's basically the way the DHT binds into that N-terminus domain of the androgen receptor and potentially might induce those very unique conformational changes of the androgen receptor that seems to dominate over other androgen ligands. So that seems to be the 3-keto group on the A ring of the steroid skeleton. But interestingly, it also seems to be a cyano group that's been added to SARMs that seems to do that. So the developers of SARMs, I don't think they're working off any sort of structural activity relationship models specifically. I mean, they're probably some very, very broad ones, but that cyano group that's common amongst pretty much all the SARMs seems to cross over with that 3-keto group. But as I said, we're probably getting a little bit more into more speculative terms there. Yeah. So we can go into safety form. We've kind of touched it a little bit, like here and there. Should we go into it?
I'd love to, because I want to sort of explore like the biggest drawbacks with orally active like androgenic compounds like Anavar or the other ones you mentioned before, is the fact that they can be hepatotoxic, so affecting the liver, and also perturbing cholesterol parameters or cholesterol markers. So maybe do you want to sort of explain that?
Yeah. We'll go into the cholesterol one. We'll start there. So much like any androgen administered orally, obviously they're going to go through the liver. Liver's major site of cholesterol metabolism. Lipid skewing forms that characteristic adverse effect. It's common even in injected androgens, but like, you know, with as I mentioned, with it quite literally having to go through the liver after being swallowed, it's going to be one of the major things. And that is something that's noted in pretty much all the safety data, including that in children. And obviously in the modern environment, that's something that's a little bit more closely monitored now that we're sort of aware of it. And it seems to occur via HDL suppression through inducing hepatic triglyceride lipase. So that's an enzyme that that hydrolyzes lipoproteins. And it seems to prematurely hydrolyze HDL, the high density lipoproteins, and by consequence increases LDL concentration. So where you could have, like, say, a HDL concentration of like 3 mmol/L, and you hydrolyze that, you're taking an oral androgen, it might drop down and then your LDL will come up. So it's not necessarily, well, it could be an increase in total cholesterol concentration, because there is some indications that some androgens can induce HMG-CoA reductase, which is the enzyme responsible, or the terminal enzyme responsible for cholesterol synthesis. So it can do that. But the more common thing is that lipid skewing. So it's just changing those ratios around as a result of inducing hepatic triglyceride lipase. So obviously, this is an adverse effect that might only become problematic in pre-existing cardiovascular diseases, depending on how much, because it is really idiosyncratic how someone will result to that. Like, you can look at all the data, the safety data. There is rather large fluxes, and some people in the clinical data didn't even show any of it at all. Or maybe even in prolonged use. But it's certainly, you know, so you got, like,
do you think this would be also dose dependent though? Like, the higher the dose, the more the skewing effect?
Potentially as well. Yeah. Because I can only really go off that, 0.1 milligram per kilo of dosing, then, you know, we've got to pretty much standardize, but potentially, yeah. That might be the case. And, you know, I don't like to talk about PED use, but people often use concomitant androgens as well. Like, So there's that. And then, the liver stuff, it's the liver effects are generally what you would, expect from an orally administered androgen, saving for the lower propensity for liver injury. So there seems to be a liver effect, but it seems to have a lower propensity for liver injury compared to other oral androgens, or even other oral androgens with that seven alpha methyl substitute. So there does appear to be transient elevation of liver transaminase enzymes at initiation, but this does seem to wane over time. And as I mentioned before, we have that 2-year trials, like continuous trials in children, and one of them's done in adults over 18. We got that complete 2 years, so we can really get a good gauge of what's happening with the liver transaminase in there. And if there's a sort of a waning in those, then that's probably a more positive sign that it has less propensity to cause liver injury. So I'm not sure we could chalk up the initial spike as cause of propensity for liver injury in every case, although there does definitely seem to be rarer cases of more overt liver injury with the oxandrolone use. So the typical liver injury profile of oral androgens made orally bioavailable via that 17 alpha methyl substitution, so like with that you see liver injury, is one that sort of more looks like intrahepatic cholestasis. So as well as the serum transaminase levels rising, you'll get elevations in bilirubin, suggesting sort of backlogging bile due to either damage to the biliary caniculi or some degree of occlusion of the biliary ducts. And with this profile, due to the cholestasis and damage to the bile buildup, you'll see transaminases continue to climb. Like they won't be like a spike and then sort of dropping off. They just keep going up, depending on the degree of cholestasis or if the cholestasis is worsening. So, which doesn't seem to be the case with the oxandrolone data. So, in fact, in the Burns patients data, where measured, the the Burns injury itself seemed to increase the liver transaminase levels. Well, they might not necessarily have been liver transaminase levels. They could have been skeletal muscle transaminase levels, which are obviously indiscernible in bioassays. And by large, it was not too different from those who were taking the oxandrolone. So the changes in the liver transaminase were not too much. And as mentioned, there's very select reports of actual liver injury, including those of case reports of anabolic steroid use. But as I said, there's only so much we can actually glean from those. As mentioned, that prior metabolic resistance is probably the contributing factor to the seemingly lower propensity for causing liver injuries in comparison to the other 17 alpha alkylating androgens, because it appears there's no liver biotransformation where there is with some others, as we mentioned with the kinetics, the resistance to metabolism, and not being a substrate for those sort of major enzymes. And so it'll avoid pharmacokinetic drug interactions as well, but also potentially that liver toxicity by sparing the limited enzyme cofactors like glutathione and things like that.
What about at dosages? Well, in that study, when they used 0.1 milligram per kilogram body weight, did they also assess red blood cell count and hemoglobin?
Yeah. So in the later ones they did, there was no changes. And that's another one of those parameters that wasn't really looked at in the earlier trials as well. So if we go back to what we started off with mentioning that, yeah, that's another one of those things that wasn't mentioned. There was no appreciable changes. Like if they weren't clinically significant enough to sort of pick that up. Not all the safety data did, but some of it did. Not all the safety trials did, but some of the published ones did. There is an association of oxandrolone with some forms of liver cancer. However, this has been reported in those rare anemic diseases that I mentioned, and where there's been that sort of multiple concurrent anabolic regime. And also in concurrent anabolic regime for an extended period. So there's also data to suggest actually some liver marker improvements, not specifically as a result of improving liver function, but when using oxandrolone in acute burn victims. So I certainly wouldn't take this to say, oh, oxandrolone is good for the liver, or, you know. But in these patients, the oxandrolone reduced some acute phase proteins, which is probably as a result of the liver injury and reducing that sort of proteolysis, and increased some serum proteins, which can be interpreted as liver marker improvements in the recovery from the hypermetabolic trauma. But once again, this is no green light to say it's unreserved liver safety. Yeah. So that probably covers the liver safety. When I was sort of looking at this, I wanted to sort of see some sort of relevance to real world application. So I went and digged in some pharmacovigilance data, and I went to the TGA DAEN, the database of adverse effect notifications. So that's the pharmacovigilance log in Australia. And since its approval in Australia, in close to 50 years, there's been 7 cases of adverse reports, whereby four were oxandrolone was the single suspected causative agent, and two of those four were back pain, and the others were changes in hepatic function and lipometabolism. But I guess it's probably what you expect from a medicine with such narrow therapeutic indications and uses in rare diseases. So not very many adverse reports, but it'd be interesting to compare that to actual prescriptions and to see. And then I got a broader perspective. I went to the VigiAccess, which is the World Health Organization Pharmacovigilance Public Database. And that was launched in 2015, but it did grandfather in some prior pharmacovigilance data. So with this data from 1973 to 2003, there was 238 reports from reporting countries, which seemed to mainly affect adults over 45. So maybe it was used for that osteoporosis bone pain indication. And that seemed to peak around 2008. So that's probably more evidence to the fact that that's probably what it was. And then there was no real trends or standout in terms of the composition of these adverse effects. 33 of that, was it 238, were hepatobiliary disorders. And were probably out of all the adverse events reported, because they have to sort of, you have to sort of pick down a drop box. they're probably the only ones that are relevant adverse effects that sort of had some consistency with the trial data, so the hepatobiliary disorder. But there was curiously large, I think it was like over 30%, general disorders categorization that counted for most of them. And so I'm going, well, what is a general disorder? Like, how can you say that, you know, it's just giving you a general side effect? And so I want to look that up. It says that this is defined as a class of disorders that encompasses conditions of general kind that result from a disease, the treatment of disease or administration of treatment of a particular site, and are manifested by a characteristic set of symptoms and signs. So you can interpret that how you will. So, yeah. So, you know, in terms of like comparison to other androgens, you know, it seems safer in terms of just going on this limited pharmacovigilance data. So, yeah. Mm. Yeah. So that's probably the safety all bottled up there, mate.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of like in terms of the dosages, things like that, when they were using them clinically, were they prescribed in, I know you said 0.1 milligram per kilogram, but typically now, like when they're using them in prescription medication, are they, what, 20 milligram tablets, like 10 milligram? Like...
Yeah, so they used to come as 2.5s in Australia. And I believe there was a 2.5 and a 10 of the oxandrin. So the Lonavar was 2.5. I believe the oxandrin, which was never really sold in Australia, was 2.5s and 10s. So, right. Yeah, I'm not sure how that sort of fitted into the indications there and like generally... or the approvals for the indications there. I mean, yeah, that's generally how it was, but yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then maybe we can finish off with like how bodybuilders maybe have over time, like leveraged Anavar. Obviously this is, yeah, not medical advice. Mm. But maybe you want to share like where it's been used in the bodybuilding space, like maybe how people have used it.
Oh, mate, I can only really go off my observations. I've essentially detached myself from anything to do with any sort of advice or anything like that. But yeah, like, you know, you hear the whispers and social media posts that people are really, you know, unreservedly disclosing. It's crazy to me. You hear like Anavar, you know, in female use, which kind of blows my mind a little bit. Yeah.
Is that because, does it actually have any virilizing effects?
I mean, like some of the data in the children showed virilizing. It was minimal. But yeah, even at those doses. So, you know, we're talking, you know, at most a 50 kilo child, was it 50 milligrams per day. That was showing some signs of virilization. It was like it wasn't in all subjects, but there was some that seemed this sort of exquisitely androgen sensitive. So,
the transgender population would be like liking to hear this.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, as I said, like it's you've got minimum options of an oral androgen that can you know resist metabolism and has a relatively that the profile itself allows for some degree of scaling. Like there's a little bit more degree of scaling. Like it's most androgens are pretty narrow in their effect, but because there is that, you know, we can look at that sort of intracellular trafficking data and then more broadly those, the Hirschberger data, and we can sort of extrapolate out from there. But like, you know, as I said, this is venturing into the realms of off-label use that, you know, I don't really like to speak about at all. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, yeah. I think that pretty much, unless you had any other maybe areas you're excited to see further research on, like if you're hoping to see further research in a particular, for a particular application in the future.
In relation to what I sort of looked at with this, that all that intracellular trafficking and that co-repressor, co-activator profiling and the transcriptome, you know, so that's the mRNA transcribed as a result of a nuclear receptor activation translocation. That sort of stuff really interests me because you know, with nuclear receptors, they don't really, I probably should have spoken to this in the safety aspect, but with nuclear receptors, they're sort of unlike other sort of, other receptors, cell membrane receptor bound receptors, like, or even drug targets like enzymes or ion channels or G-protein coupler receptors, nuclear receptors, they're significantly more plastic and their effects are significantly more diverse. So where you'll have a, where you have, I think my family just come home, where you'll have effect from the activation of a nuclear receptor, the scaling of the doses is not necessarily limited to the actual receptor itself. So right. The receptor itself can upregulate. I mean, other receptors do this, but the actual, like just going off the fact that you can skew that androgenic to anabolic ratio by virtue of the dose and to make it more androgenic, that in itself just gives an indication as to how nuclear receptors themselves, they're very unique insofar as the dosing and molecular interactions are so diverse, rather than like a beta 2 receptor. You have a beta 2 receptor ligand, it can bind in there with a specific intrinsic activity, and then you'll get a certain magnitude of effect as a result of that, and it can be outcompeted with a nuclear receptor. It's significantly more complex. But that's where I'm sort of Where I've taken an interest in now as a result of learning this.
Awesome. I'll make sure to leave some of the research articles that you may have utilized in this podcast. I'll make sure to get them off you so I can link them in the show notes for those listening in. But otherwise, Nick, thanks so much for jumping on the podcast. Really in-depth discussion for those wanting to learn more about, this particular medication. Again, obviously nothing here is medical advice. This is purely for informational purposes only. But otherwise, Nick, it's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks, matey.
Awesome.
Thank you, everyone, for joining in to today's episode. For in-depth show notes and lessons learned, visit nofilter.media/boostyourbiology.
This has been a No Filter Media production.
Say what you want.